Hello, Lorena Allen with you for Hindsight. Welcome to the program. And a rather grim anniversary. It's 30 years since the death of Bobby Sands. In the spring and summer of 1981, 10 Republican prisoners in the H Block section of the Mays Prison outside Belfast undertook a hunger strike to the death, with the aim of achieving special category status for those convicted under Northern Ireland's extensive anti-terrorist and emergency laws. They were led by Bobby Sands, the officer commanding the provisional IRA prisoners. This program features a number of rare interviews with Republicans recorded in Ireland in 1981 by Brendan Frost. Jim Short from South Armagh looks back at the events of 30 years ago and reflects on the present situation in Northern Ireland. My brother is not a criminal. Bobby Sands and the H Block hunger strikes.
For my aunt, who was born in 1906 and as a child remembered the Easter uprising of 1916, the deaths of the hunger strikers reminded her of the way in which the British had executed the leaders of the Easter uprising of 1916. Those guys had been executed in batches of three and four over the period of a week, and every day was a revelation of Britain's callousness, the injustice. It was driving a nail home. With every execution in 1916, it had the effect of galvanizing the population. The hunger strikers evoked the same response. It resonated in the same way.
The man leading this second hunger strike is Bobby Sands, a 27-year-old Belfast man who has spent all but a few months of the past 8 years in prison on arms charges, and he's a spokesman for over 400 protesting provisional IRA prisoners. Friends say he's a hard man who's quite prepared to fast to death.
A member of the provisional IRA currently on a hunger strike in the Mays Prison Hospital has been elected to the British Parliament. This report from John Deering in Belfast.
Sands, Bobby, anti-H Block, Armagh, political prisoner, 30,492.
The shock results to one of the most unusual elections in British history.
The sound of garbage bins and whistles in Belfast conveying the news of the death of Bobby Sands, which, as had been widely expected, has set off a new wave of rioting and bitterness in Northern Ireland.
In 1921, the War of Independence more or less came to an end, and then the British pulled out of the 26 counties in the south of Ireland, and they left a stateless in the north, which essentially was the largest landmass possible compatible with permanent Protestant rule.
The fundamental cause of the troubles is the inherently and irreformably undemocratic nature of the Northern Ireland state.
Eamon McCann, writer.
Moreover, the structures of the Northern state were inherently undemocratic in that they were tied into the political structures of the Unionist Party and the Orange Order and all its other adjuncts. I mean, the state machinery was coterminous, if you like, with the political apparatus of unionism, and therefore the state cannot operate democratically. It wasn't built for the purpose.
Prime Minister in the 1930s famously described Stormont, which was the seat of government, as being a Protestant parliament for a Protestant people.
There were poor times, the 20s, 30s, 40s. People were mainly interested in subsistence, and so the poor national population had to go cap in hand begging for subsistence alone.
Our people seen they were going to be wiped out, so they just sat and took it, they had to take it. They thought partition would only be for a while, but remember, I heard my mother saying it maybe only for about 4 years or something till everything gets slowly in, you know, but it never came. It never came.
They systematically underfunded Catholic or nationalist areas and systematically discriminated in voting and in placement of jobs in Protestant areas. And therefore they operated a two-class system whereby Catholics were on the bottom of the pile.
When you went for a job, you knew partition all right.
Mrs. Murray.
Because you couldn't get a job. Just like the Negroes. I would say there's no difference between the Negro population to what my mother went through. For to keep us out of the workhouse, as she called it, we had to become, well, she was a dealer. My father couldn't get work. And my brothers, I think my father got 2 years' work in his lifetime.
I mean, even at that time, there was property voting, which would seem an extraordinary thing to people outside. There wasn't one man, one vote. In local elections, there was a property qualification, so that one man, because of his property, might have six votes over your one man. And as Catholics being the poorer element, of course, they hadn't a chance as regards that kind of voting rights.
In the 1960s, following the example of the black civil rights marchers in the United States, Irish Catholics and moderate Protestants as well began to demonstrate against the iniquity of the situation. They met with increasing hostility from the Northern Ireland state.
See, there's always two ways to remedy a situation.
Father Raymond Murray.
There is the
prison chaplain.
Way of truth and justice, fair play and generosity. And unless that's done, if there's no redress against injustice, well, there is the danger that other people will seek another way, the way of violence, and that will happen, inevitably happen. But people who have power and privilege don't like giving it up. They become arrogant, and they don't even understand after a while the very thoughts, the aspirations, or the needs of other groups. And that is why when the civil rights started, after a while, the answer of the government to the just demands was repression.
And it culminated in the summer of 1969, when a Protestant demonstration led to riots in Derry. Essentially, the Northern Ireland Police Force, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the resistance was so great that they broke down and they could not control the situation anymore. In that context, James Callaghan, who was the Home Secretary in a Labour government in Britain, sent in the British Army. People looked upon the defeat of the Royal Ulster Constabulary as a victory. And there was a certain honeymoon period with the British Army. But even at the time, the leader of the then Nationalist Party in Northern Ireland, a man called Eddie McAteer, said that this is going to, sooner or later, lead to trouble.
The essence of the problem is a human rights or civil rights problem, because the law as such is being used as an instrument of oppression. Repression of the people by the law is the policy of the government.
Father Dennis Fall, prison chaplain.
Brigadier Kitson of the British Army summed it up in his book on low intensity operations when he said that the law must become a propaganda instrument of the government in order to get rid of undesirable members of the community. Well, in terms of the British and Northern Ireland, undesirable persons are persons who disagree with British rule in Ireland. They are persons who object to the lack of civil rights for Catholics, persons who object to bad housing, 40% unemployment in Catholic districts, the fact that Catholics always get the rough edge or the heavy edge of the law. The British used the law, therefore, ruthlessly to maintain their power and their presence in Ireland. So the problem, therefore, is to try to get the British Army and the Royal Ulster Constabulary and the other agencies of the British in Ireland to try to get them to keep their own law.
In the area where I come from, which is on the border, there was a campaign to block all roads, apart from one or two designated approved roads, leading from the north into the south. I remember in 1970, we had a very good football team. We had won the under-16 championship, and we were aiming to win the under-18 championship. And we were training on the football field, and there was an explosion, and two policemen were blown up. And this was a trigger for unionist politicians to clamor for the closing of the roads, the cross-border roads. My mother was born 3 miles from where she now lives, but 1 mile inside the Republic of Ireland's border. The approved road meant that we would have had to drive 19 miles in order to visit my grandmother. So local people, people not involved in the Republican movement or that at all, came out with picks and shovels and spread diesel and oil on the ground to prevent concrete setting, and systematically, night after night, for 12 or 13 nights, moved the bollards until eventually the army gave up. They couldn't do it. The Protestants on their side began to marshal and formed organisations like the Ulster Defence Association, Ulster Volunteer Force, and a number of sectarian attacks and murders of Catholics took place.
I am a proud young Irishman in Ulster's hills. My life.
Horrific things have happened in the north, and there's no doubt that if you go through the past 10 years' history, I mean, there have been actions by Republican paramilitaries which cannot be defended on any ground, and sort of one's reaction to them is one of simple human horror. However, the balance of terror has certainly not lain with the Provisional IRA or with those against the state. I mean, the terror overwhelmingly has come from the much better armed and much better trained and more supported machines, the British Army and the RUC and the loyalist paramilitaries and loyalist murder gangs. But the other political point is that the IRA is fighting against the existence of the Northern State. Whatever about their methods and whatever one thinks about them, they are correct in their perception that the Northern Ireland State is inherently undemocratic, and that British support and sustenance for the Northern Ireland State is the root cause of the trouble.
That Britain might grant Ireland's fight 800 years of crime.
And then in the summer of 1971, the British government, in collusion with the Stormonts, announced internment without trial, in which they rounded up scores and scores of men who were associated maybe with Gaelic football teams, including a man who had taught me at primary school, Kevin McMahon. They didn't really know who they were rounding up, but they took in the usual suspects anyway.
On the 8th of August in 1971, our vice chairwoman, who was a nurse, was on the Antrim Road.
Frances Murray, Association for Legal Justice.
And a man came out and stopped her car and asked her to attend to a man who was just released out of Gairdrie. It was Elisha Anderson, one of the first internees, and his feet were in a bad state. He'd been badly burnt in the feet. And Rita attended to him, and he told us stories about the other people who had been released with him. And we were horrified, and got a list of names of them, decided we'd hold a press conference, and thought we only had to relate these abuses for them to be stopped. How naive we were in those days.
2 days before internment was introduced, there were a couple of men from South Armagh, Harry Thornton and a guy in the passenger seat called Arthur Murphy. They stopped at traffic lights in Belfast, and the van they had backfired, and a British Army platoon opened fire and killed Harry Thornton. They took Arthur Murphy out of the van and beat him black and blue. Arthur Murphy came into our pub about 2 or 3 weeks later and took off his shirt, and his chest and back, his entire torso, was the colour of a man with nicotine-stained hands, yellow and brown from the beating that he'd received. There were riots in Cross Madeleine on that night, and then internment was introduced a couple of nights later, and there were more riots in Cross Madeleine outside the police barracks, which later became the British Army base.
To understand the five demands to understand the hunger strike, you have to understand how the situation arose in the first place.
Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey.
Now that goes right back to the introduction of internment in 1971.
Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey had been involved in the civil rights movement in the late 1960s. She was elected to Parliament, and I think was the youngest parliamentarian since William Pitt the Younger. There's a famous picture of her in 1969 smashing on the road a paving stone to make up small stones to throw at the police in Derry in 1969. Famous picture of her in jeans.
Internment was a weapon used by the Northern Ireland government at regular intervals from the formation of the state. And up until its use in 71, it had by and large been successful in removing from the community people who organised, agitated, etc. The government miscalculated in 71, and when it interned several hundred people, the reaction was the direct opposite of previous occasions. It actually caused it to flare up into where there had been thousands before, tens of thousands. People flocked into the street to prevent their neighbours being arrested.
With the introduction of internments, Northern Ireland more or less exploded. This was seen as a direct assault on the Catholic minority, but this time they weren't taking it lying down. Eventually, in March 1972, the Stormont government was prorogued, I think is the expression, namely abolished, and direct rule was then imposed from Westminster.
Now, that in turn meant that the undemocratic laws on the Northern Ireland government books were now being directly carried out by London, which meant that London was in breach of a number of international agreements because of the Special Powers Act. The pressure on Britain, therefore, was to attempt to get itself out of the international embarrassment of internment, which was under the Special Powers Act, the resistance movement on the streets that it created, but at the same time, to produce the same effect as internment, and that was to get as many people as possible who were responsible either legitimately or illegally for organising against the state behind bars. So they devised the system that they called the due process of law. Now, before internment, during internment and after internment, the ordinary legal system existed. So due process of law ought simply to have been to abandon internment and to go back to the legal system. That is not what happened. What happened is that the government in London passed the Northern Ireland Emergency Provisions Act and repealed the Special Powers Act. One merely updated the other, being worded in a way so as not to contravene the international agreements. They set up an entire new legal system to run side by side with the normal courts. That was the diplock or non-jury courts. They set up special rights of interrogation of the police, and they altered the rules of evidence. For example, habeas corpus does not apply to persons charged with offences under the Emergency Provisions Act schedule. Such persons are not entitled to the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. They're not entitled to trial by jury. And the statistics are that the special non-jury courts have a 98% conviction rate. Now, that is higher than any other country in the world, even the banana republics and dictatorships.
The diplock courts are an absolute disgrace. Absolute disgrace. The most bizarre things can happen here in the courts. You can be standing in front of a judge with a broken arm and a black eye, which you have just received in Castlereagh, and solicitors here have brought these facts up in front of judges in the court only to be told by the judge that is not a matter for this court. The powers of the police are such that in any court, no matter how many witnesses you may have to prove to the contrary, if a policeman stands up and says you made a statement in Castlereagh, either verbal or otherwise, that is accepted.
Very grave torture, sensory deprivation, beatings. I, as a prison chaplain, witnessed all that because I saw the prisoners brought in black and blue. Terrible injuries, terrible beatings, amphetamine drugs, electric shocks, cattle prods, all these kind of things were used. So So this is a very great problem. It's a matter of history now. It's accepted everywhere because we had two Amnesty International reports, 1972, 1978. We had the Strasbourg Commission decision. We had the Strasbourg Court decision. We had even domestic reports from the British government themselves, the Compton report, the Parker Gardner report, the Bennett report. But this was a very great problem for us.
Castlereagh was barracks outside Belfast, which was run by the special branch. And there were detention centres there, but it was more known as interrogation centres. They also kept people in a prison ship in Belfast Harbour. Gays escaped from that, because there's a long history of Irish Republicans, you know, escaping from prisons in the same way as prisoners of war would have considered it their duty to escape from German or Japanese camps if they could. So Irish Republican prisoners consider that they're prisoners of war and it's their duty to escape as well.
Now, of that 98% conviction rate, on the government's own admission, some 85% of those convicted are convicted solely on the basis of their own testimony, that is, they confess. Despite the fact that the majority of the confessions are contested in court by the defendants. But for your confession to be ruled inadmissible, you have to prove that it has been extracted as a result of torture. Now, the British definition of torture, according to the Compton Inquirer, is the dictionary definition of sadism, in that you must not only have had physical or mental punishment inflicted upon you, but the person responsible for it had to have taken enjoyment in it. It's not a very legal definition. So we have a very, very special court system. We have special powers of arrest and special rights of interrogation. The police can detain in successive periods of 7 days by simply renewing the order for an unlimited period of time. Any person, until they literally beat a confession out of him.
Fergus O'Hare, Belfast City Councillor, founding member of the Northern Resistance Movement.
Some of the stories which have come out of Castlereagh are horrendous. Most of the people who are arrested are young men in their late teens, early 20s, and are brought there to Castlereagh, are beaten up by large numbers of RUC men who are physically tortured, abused, who are threatened with sectarian assassinations, because a number of people have been arrested by the RUC and have subsequently been found either in loyalist areas, murdered by loyalist assassination squads, or thrown into the River Ligon or somewhere like this. So young people are brought there and are threatened that if they don't sign these confessions, that they will be brought to the Shankill Road or some other loyalist area and will be left there and picked up presumably by the UDA, the Ulster Defence Association, or one of the other loyalist assassination squads. And that's a very real threat to young people being brought there, because it has happened in the past and they know that. So you have straight beatings, torture, you have intimidation and threats such as this. There was the case of one young man from County Tyrone who was brought to Castlereagh and asked to sign a statement, refused to sign it, was beaten up and tortured, still refused to sign it. And after a number of days with the young lad, managed to refrain under extreme torture from signing the statement. They went out and arrested his father. They brought his father into the next cell beside him and proceeded to beat his father around the cell. And the young lad was sitting there and had to listen to the screams of his father. It subsequently turned out that when they had finished with his father had to go into a mental asylum. McGrath was the man's name. As a result of that, not as a result of his own torture, but as a result of hearing his father been tortured to the extent where his father was put into a mental institution, the young lad did sign the statement and is now in the H blocks. And this is the sort of excruciating torture and brutality which is used against young people from the anti-unionist ghettos in the north of Ireland. And this is the sort of procedure by which they are processed through the torture centres, through the juryless courts, and end up in the H block. So it starts with the torture and it ends up with young people dying in hunger strike.
Well, we know, of course, that the sensory deprivation torture when 14 men at the beginning of the 9th of August, and then later on October, two more men were taken away for 6 days, disappeared from the face of the earth. Nobody knew where they were. They were stripped, hooded, a rough boiler suit put on them and over the naked body. And for 6 days, they were in darkness, standing against the wall, tips of the fingers against the wall, legs outstretched. When they were exhausted, they fell down. They were brought in, interrogated, beaten, had to toilet where they stood, and deprived of food and just a little water, and that for 6 days. Now, that was sanctioned at cabinet level, the British government, and I mean, that was clear in the Compton report.
In the light of events in Abu Ghraib and other places, clearly the same techniques, white noise, preventing people from sleeping, reports of men being thrown out of helicopters when the helicopter was hovering 4 or 5 feet off the ground, blindfolded, sensory deprivation, following a counterinsurgency manual, which I think was by a guy called Frank Kitson. Sir Frank Kitson.
In Northern Ireland, you've never had a situation without emergency laws. Since the setting up of this abortion of a statelet in 1921, it has had special powers and emergency laws. At the moment, we are ruled by the Emergency Provisions Act and the Prevention of Terrorism Act of 1976, which between them give the police and army more sweeping powers than any government in South Africa has at the moment. The British would assert, I suppose, that these powers are necessary to maintain law and order. We assert that these powers are necessary for them to maintain their presence in Ireland. It's an interesting historical fact that since the Act of Union in 1800, which united the kingdoms of Great Britain and Ireland, since 1800, Ireland has never been without emergency laws or coercion laws, as they were known in the 19th century, except for 12 years when Gladstone was the ruler of Britain and was trying to entice the Catholics to support him by offering them home rule, which he couldn't carry through the Parliament. So the point is that the British have always broken their own laws in order to maintain their presence in Ireland, and they have done it very much in the present crisis. They've killed over 120 completely innocent people. They've tortured, to my knowledge, about 1,500 persons, which cases we have documented. And for these crimes, no British soldier, no RAC man has ever been convicted or has ever spent a day in jail. Whereas the little boy on the Falls Road of the Bogside, who steps out of the line, throws a stone or a blast bomb or something else, he receives the maximum severity of the law, probably gets a 20-year sentence. That's the background behind Long Cash. Continual injustice. The fact that the families from which they come, 80% of them, are families which never had anybody in jail before. It's perfectly obvious that the British require hostages. First they had the internees, now it has to have the prisoners produced by the Castlereagh Torture Centre, which is a statement mill. There's the whole farce here of the law. So all I'm really saying to the British government is, keep your own laws. Try to keep within the wide parameter of the most impressive set of emergency laws which exists in Europe.
In January 1972, the British Army shot and killed 13 people on Bloody Sunday. In the House of Commons a couple of days later, the Home Secretary said that the army had been fired on first and that it was shooting in self-defence, all of which has subsequently been acknowledged to be false. Bernard Devlin famously crossed the floor and struck him across the face.